Hey guys, welcome to Entrepreneurs Uncut. Today we have Daniel Davis on the show, and Daniel is a certified EOS implementer. He's also quite an accomplished entrepreneur and has quite an incredible background of starting, building, and exiting businesses right throughout his career. He's achieved amazing things, but what really struck me in my interview today with Daniel was just how raw, open, and candid he was about his past. Not just the ups, but particularly the downs, what he's had to endure to get to where he is. You know, I take my hat off to him. It wasn't easy at times sitting in the interview, but you know, credit to the man. He opened up, and I think there's a lot to learn from this podcast. So listen in, guys, and let's get to the show. Daniel Davis, welcome to Entrepreneurs Uncut.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be here.
Mate, I was thinking about when getting you on the podcast, and I thought a good way to kick off would be just to kind of bring it back a fair few years now, and maybe, you know, in the early days, or maybe, you know, I remember in the early days sitting around kind of the family table for dinner, what that was like, my parents, my mum cooking, and my dad coming home late from work, and he was a business owner, and just remember kind of growing up in that environment, and you know, pretty stable, pretty steady, pretty kind of orthodox. What was it like for you growing up when you were young?
Pretty different to that. I was just listening to that thinking that sounds pretty good. Certainly wasn't like that. My parents weren't so united. So they split pretty early on, I think when I was a year old. And
you were one.
Yeah, I was maybe not even one actually. And then my mum met another guy and they had my sister when I was two, I think it was. And he was not the nicest of guys. And so he was involved in, bikey operation. So I guess he worked some description. I'm not sure exactly what he did, but there wasn't quite that stability growing up. It was pretty chaotic, quite different. Certainly don't have any memories of sitting around the kitchen table, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So a little bit different for my early years. Yeah.
When did that start to change? The environment start to change?
My mum did have a couple of different partners over the years. So unfortunately she just didn't have a great choice, in men, I guess. So they all had their issues. So I think early on I just learnt to kind of keep to myself, stay out of the way. You won't get hurt if you stay out of the way. So I think most of my time was obviously either in my room or just out of the house altogether. Where that changed was when I got to high school. I was really fortunate, met some great mates, and they came from different cultures, having grown up in Western Sydney. I got exposed to other families, and much like what you just described, that's what I started to get to experience. So one great friend I had, Turkish guy, Musa, still friends with him to this day, you know him, and got to go inside his family. Very different environment.
Hugely different, yeah.
Yeah, Turkish family, Muslim family, and very traditional. But I just admired it from a very early stage. I loved the fact that everyone ate at the dinner table together. The food was fantastic. That was always an upside. And, I got to experience a culture that I hadn't seen before. There were some differences, certainly some differences to what I was used to. But very united family. They had a lot of fun together. That was nice. And then also met some other friends, just Australian friends, but they actually had parents that were functional, I guess. And that was nice, staying over their place. You kind of get to that 13 years old, 12, 13 years old. It's pretty common to stay over and at your mate's place and get to see how other people live. So I was blessed with that. I really had some great friends that provided great influence for me to see how life could be.
Was that hard for you, going into their house and seeing how they, you know, how life was for them. Was that really tough for you at that age?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely had its moments. I think all of us have why me moments, be it coming from that background or even just getting a speeding fine, right? We all have why me moments. I think most of all, I just enjoyed being lucky enough to have the insight as to, hey, this could be better. Because life up until that point, I got to tell you, it was pretty miserable. And it was still miserable at the time. But when you see that, you kind of think, hey, this things could be better.
There's hope.
Yeah, there's hope. Yeah, not everyone gets beaten up by their dads at night time. So it might be, maybe there's some better things out there. So I actually just took it as a positive. And I loved it. I loved weekends because I was able to stay at my mate's place. So that was good.
Gosh, and I mean, I know a bit about your background story, so but for the listeners, it might be new. But even just, you know, from what I know, getting to that point where you started to have those mates and started to be able to be welcome in those households and see that different life, I mean, you still went through a process of, you know, I think it was over 10 schools to get there. Is that right?
Yeah, that's probably why it's funny when you say it. I was trying to think to myself, why was it around that 12, 13 years of age that things started to change? I hadn't worked it out until you asked that. Yeah, I went to 13 schools before I got to year seven. So I had met, I guess, a couple of people along the way, but it was really hard to make friends. And when you're moving constantly, it's hard to get any kind of traction at school. So I had assumed that I wasn't very intelligent because I wasn't learning anything at school. Most of the time I was just trying to stay out of trouble. And, yeah, you just don't get to – I didn't grow up like other people where I had friendships prior to that. As luck has it, after all those schools, there was one school that I went to, I think it was year three and four, okay, which was the longest I stayed at any school, and that was Guildford Public School. And
Not Marylands High,
no. That was the last one that I went to prior to going into high school. And I met those guys, Marylands Public, sorry. I met those guys again at high school. So when I went to Marylands High, I met those friends that I'd met in year three and four, and we kind of reconnected. And they're still mates to this day. So that was good. And I think stability just kicked in then. When I got to year seven, life changed. I was getting old enough to look after myself, and I was not prepared to change schools anymore. So I ended up leaving home shortly after. Yeah, I think it was year eight. Going into year nine, that was the end of me staying around. I'd gotten a job at 10, my first job. And I loved it.
Doing what?
Working in a timber yard in Regent's Park, Western Sydney. Loved it. It was the best job. Just sweeping the floors, packing the shelves, anything they wanted me to do, loading the truck. But I earned $4 an hour, which gave me $24 a week back then. It was fantastic. Still have very fond memories of getting paid every week in cash. And so that was my first taste of freedom, I think, and independence. By the time I was 12, I had three jobs outside of school. So I was earning enough money to be able to move out of home at 13 and rent a room in a house and just go from there independently, which was great.
It's amazing. And, I mean, you know, just listening to you, knowing your story and just listening so far, it strikes me, no one's going to doubt me on this, you've had a very challenging upbringing from some of the things that you said there. You know, it's things that I think a lot of people have never experienced and, you know, hopefully will never go through. At that young age, when you mentioned how much you loved that job, the timber yard, I could see in your physical reaction, you know, that you really loved it. Were you loving it because of the actual job, or was it a form of escapism?
Yeah, look, it was definitely an escape, but it was actually the first time I think I'd ever realized that I carried any sense of value to anyone, right? So I grew up in an environment and we didn't hug each other. We didn't talk to one another. I don't think anyone truly worried too much about where I was or what I was doing. And so going into the workplace, and obviously school was really hard, as I shared.
Yeah.
Teachers didn't understand why I was struggling. Nobody really bothered to look into why I was changing schools all the time. They didn't inquire about the domestic violence that was going on at home. And so I was pretty much lost in a system. And then suddenly I had this job where I was somebody. I was part of a team and they did care.
Did they?
Even if they cared, what are you doing? Like, you should be sweeping the floor.
Yeah.
They cared.
You had some significance.
It mattered, yeah. And if I swept that floor well, they appreciated it. If I loaded the truck quickly, they liked it, you know, and so.
And they tell you?
Yeah, yeah. That was the first time I think anyone had ever said anything nice. They're like, Dan, you work like a man. You're like, geez, you're strong.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's really cool, like, to have that compliment.
Yeah.
And I think I got addicted to it. I really enjoyed being part of a team and feeling like at the end of the day, they, you know, we'd shut the timber yard and they'd say, great job, Dan. You nailed it. See you next week. And I used to think, shit, well, I wouldn't mind seeing you on Monday, actually. I'd like to quit school. If I get any full-time jobs going, I'll come back.
Yeah.
So it was a sense of belonging, I think, and self-worth. And, you know, I've long been a believer that we should be getting people into the workforce younger because they just don't know what they don't know. A lot of people don't fit into the school system. A lot of people have dysfunctional families and they don't understand what it is to have that self-worth. And, you know, they hang out with the wrong groups, you know, get involved with gangs. All of that is only because they want to feel like they belong and that they matter to somebody. They're not too concerned about who exactly that is that cares for them. They want to feel that sense of care. A lot of kids don't have that.
Why do you think that you didn't end up on that side and take that path of going down, you mentioned gangs or this like more destructive part of society? Because like you said, that could have been a sense of belonging too. That's how they lure people in and you know, probably do bad things. Why did you end up going down the work path? Do you ever think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think about it simply because I've been asked it before, and I think it's a combination of a couple of things. First and foremost, I could have easily, right? So most of my cousins did get involved in that. I'm pretty much the only male who didn't go to jail, actually, the last couple of generations. And they weren't bad people necessarily. They just got caught up in the wrong things, so drug dealing and things like that. It was a way to make money.
You could have gotten caught up, but you didn't.
Yeah,
do you think you've got something like a moral compass that's inside of you that's different?
Well, it probably helped that I grew up wanting to be a cop. I remember about 3 years old and watching a police officer walk past, and I looked up and thought, oh, I'd really like to be like him one day.
Thank God for that moment.
Yeah, so it was probably a good moment. I think because when you're going through that, you look at the police as a sense of safety. And I thought, I'd like to be able to give that feeling to somebody someday. And so I always grew up wanting to join the cops. It was always something that I aspired to. And I think when you have that kind of guiding goal and guiding principles, they were principles that I felt I aligned to. I'd rather be helping people and doing good than getting chased and being bad. You know, being the bad guy. I was never attracted to being the bad guy.
It's amazing you say that because how fortunate you are that you did, pick that idol and such a great example of values alignment, you know, in that you got to do the right thing, help, serve and protect. You know, that's almost like something that would have definitely kind of helped you almost on a subconscious level through those years of turbulence and,
massively. And I mean, unfortunately, as the life was, it was not uncommon for me to and my family to have the police present at home due to what was going on. And so on many circumstances, they were there to help.
Is that your opinion of them during those times, that they were like helping?
Very much so.
Because people have different opinions about the police.
No, I'm still a big fan to this day. And I feel like it's really unfortunate that the media and society has painted a brush over a couple of really poor people.
Yeah.
But I think if we stepped back for a moment, we'd realise that there's poor people in every area, in business, in government. There's many examples. And I think they should just step back and have a look at who are these people when they join the cops. They typically are joining the police because of what similar reasons to me. They want to go and help people. And I think we should show them a lot more respect than what's been going on. They often are the ones who get stuck on the front lines in between some political, you know, movement, and they're just trying to keep the peace. It's a really tough job.
Hugely. I always think, well, how about we don't have police and let's see what that looks like.
Yeah, exactly.
Complete anarchy.
Yeah, yeah. I think all of them, police, ambulance officers are just amazing. The fire brigade, all of them are people I always looked up to and still do to this day.
Mm.
Very much respect them. And I'll forever be grateful for everything they did for myself. They did lots. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, yeah, taking it back to those early teens, was that, did you know then that it was that a potential career path that you were working towards?
Definitely. Yeah, that was it actually.
And you were taking up jobs to lead you to that path. What did that path look like to getting there?
I think I knew back then the barrier to entry into the police was not particularly high, so I wasn't too concerned that I'd be able to get in someday. My only concern actually was my family's association with crime and my fear that could somehow stick to me.
Right.
Another one of the motivating reasons for me to leave home at a young age and do my own thing. I thought if I can get away from that, that'll work. I figured if I work hard, get lots of real life experience in different jobs, I'll be a great cop. I did pursue it, and I did actually enroll and pass the exams to go.
Right.
And was accepted, and then I had my first business opportunity just prior to going into the Goulburn Police Academy, the intake.
So that moment there, where was there like a fork in the road moment? You've been accepted to the cops or you know, to go to Goulburn, and you mentioned you had your first business opportunity. Was that a fork in the road where you had to make a really significant decision?
Yeah, definitely. It was tough. It was my dream job. I still think to this day it probably is my dream job. Things have certainly changed over the last couple of decades.
Yeah.
And I feel very blessed to do what I do today. I feel like it certainly fills that cup of helping people for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, it definitely was a fork in the road. But I had a very valid reason and motivation as to why I wasn't doing it. I'd gotten engaged, was getting married. You meet the, you know, the girl of your dreams, and you think you want to start a family and do all those things. And for me, at that time, it made more sense to follow the business opportunity. I knew I'd be able to provide more financially.
That was the key reason.
That was the key reason, yeah. I certainly wasn't in love with the type of business I was going into. It was more, I believed that I could provide better for the family. And so that was, I mean, police don't earn great income. I still remember exactly what they were earning. My first year income was going to be $26,000.
Wow.
And it's pretty low. And I had happened to was getting married to someone who was a scholarship student.
Yeah.
Kind of made me feel like, hey, I better step it up a little bit because this is going to get embarrassing. So, but I just, for the record, not an ounce of pressure from her whatsoever. In fact, quite the opposite. She only ever encouraged me to do what makes me happy.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, and taking it a few steps back, you know, with that first business opportunity, how did that come about?
That's a really interesting question. So I'd started working in service stations not too long after finishing high school, and I'd done so quite intentionally. I was completely and utterly introverted. I really had social skill issues. I found it hard to talk to people. Still to this day, I'm quite introverted, but I knew I had to fix it. And I thought a great opportunity to do that would be just to work in some kind of retail environment. And a friend of the family's, like that, my friend's family, he owns service stations, and I thought I could get weekend work here, even if it's doing the overnight shifts, but at least it would make me have to talk to people. I'd have to say hello. That was a big deal back then. And so I asked for a job, and I got given a job. And it was terrifying having to say hello to people and say, which pump did you fill up at?
Really?
Yeah. Terrifying. One of the most scary things I think I've done in my life, despite all the challenges. I found that really hard. It wasn't easy talking to people.
How old were you then?
I would have been 18.
Okay.
And but I loved the challenge, and I loved the environment. It was a really busy environment. There was lots to do. I am quite a neat freak, so I found that I loved retail, keeping everything really spotless. The operator who I was working for was really great at what he did. He was a top operator, had around 20 sites, 23 sites I think he had. And
big,
so
big business.
Big business, yeah, and family business. Okay. So his family worked in the business, and I liked that too. It had its challenges, but I thought this aligns with that family vision that I had.
Yeah. Is there a connection to what you saw with your friends growing up, that family?
Definitely,
culture?
Yeah. This was a Lebanese family. Again, really tight-knit family, did everything together. You know, everyone worked in the business, and it was just it was nice. I really liked it. And they made me feel like part of the family too. Which I appreciated. And so, some time passed. I ended up running three of the stores for them. And what I would do is go in really early in the morning, like 4 a.m, do all the banking and all my duties, make sure the rosters are right, all those things. I'd run around all the stores, and typically by around midday to 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I could be finished my duties.
Okay.
And then I'd call the boss and ask, where is he? Right. For two reasons. Number one is I wanted to learn from him. But the other thing was he had a really nice car, and I used to say to him, I'll drive you around to visit all the stores. Right. So I was like a chauffeur. The wonderful thing about doing that was that I was overhearing all of his phone calls whilst we're driving. So I got to hear everything that he did every day, and I learned so much just sitting in the car driving him around whilst he was working. I learned heaps. And one day an opportunity came up. He had an opportunity in the Blue Mountains, right up in Blackheath, top of the Blue Mountains, where a developer friend that they did work, this developer would find the site, build it, and he would take it, said, we've got this opportunity. We drove up there the following week, and we got to about Katoomba, and he said, this is bullshit, right? It's too far. Turn around. Right, we're going back. I don't want to side out here. And I said, well, we're nearly there. I was loving the drive. We're nearly there. We may as well just go up and say hi, and you can say hi to Joe, and then we'll head back down. And so he said, all right. So we did that. He caught up with him, told him that he's not going to take the site. I walked into town, had a quick look around, realized there's nothing up there in terms of a store to service the community. And it kind of just went from there. I asked a couple of shops, you know, what time do you shut? I realized everyone does the kind of 5 p.m. shut. And then I said, well, where does everyone work? And they said, oh, well, in the city, or at least Penrith. I said, well, what the hell do they do when they get home? Because they wouldn't get home till 7 or 8 o'clock. Where do they go for their groceries? And they just said, well, there's nothing open up here. They have to bring them with them. And I thought, this is crazy. This is a great opportunity. And so on the way home, I asked my boss at the time, I said, what would it take for me to take that store? How could I make that happen? And it went from there, basically. Over the coming months, I worked out ways to be able to finance it. He agreed to sign the lease, effectively kind of like guarantor. Wow. And he said to me, open and honest, he said, Daniel, when you run out of cash and you fail in 3 months' time, I'll come back in, I'll take it over, and you can work for me again. And I said, okay. And
it's pretty generous of him, like very generous spirit to
great guy.
I mean, you don't hear that too often.
Yep.
But you know, credit to you. I think, you know, it takes someone to make someone feel as though that they want to give that opportunity to. So I imagine that relationship between you guys must have been pretty close.
Very close. I really worked around the clock for the guy.
Yeah.
I did everything for him. And there's a couple of other important lessons baked into this that I think everyone should know. And that is, I used to work 6 and 7 days a week running these stores, and I would do everything. I'd be there till late at night. The stores were immaculate, and I was earning $550 a week cash. So no super or any of those benefits, none of that. It was just $550 flat for managing the 3 stores. It was terribly low wages, but I didn't care at all. Was not focused on it. I just wanted to be the best that I could be at what I was doing. Where I ended up winning was when I went to start my store. I had been around in that industry for 3 years. Every supplier knew me. Everyone knew me as the kid who was always, always at work and always ran a beautiful store. Mm. People used to laugh at me because I'd sweep the gutters on the street outside the stores. That's how fussy I was. I wanted to keep everything really clean. And when the day came to set up my own store, I didn't have the money. How I got it across the line was I went to the suppliers and I said, I've got this opportunity. Is there any way that you can help me? And they said, Dan, for you, we'll do anything. And what they did was they gave me credit terms that allowed me to cash flow it. So effectively, I started that store with no cash.
Yeah.
And, little shout out here. I did use my wedding fund because I had 12 months prior to my big Italian wedding that was coming up. And so I used that. But even then, we're talking 30 grand. That's how much I had to at my disposal to set up a store that costs a lot more than that to stock.
It's amazing. What was that first year like operating the store?
It was
first year in business. How old were you?
First year in business, 21.
Okay.
And it was a mix of emotions. It was exciting as hell. I still couldn't believe the opportunity that I had. I felt really, really blessed, very fortunate to have an opportunity. I'd wake up every day and just go for it. So I'd open the store in the morning, 5 a.m. open, 11 p.m. close every day of the week. It was exciting. It was very lonely, really lonely. I didn't know anyone up there. I was still, well, as I say, even today I'm still quite introverted. I find it hard meeting new people. But I think when you have that power of knowing you've got an opportunity, you can do anything. And I think, again, coming back to feeling like I was getting married, like I had everything I needed. I felt like in a matter of just 1 year, everything fell into place.
Yeah.
And I felt like I had all the energy in the world too. Very rarely did I ever feel tired despite doing those hours. Just felt really fortunate and focused.
Good time in your life, looking back?
Yeah. Look, I think it's definitely very different to what other young people are doing at that time in their life. But I look back at it as that was it. If I made it, it was going to set me up, and it did.
Mm.
And I learned lots, and I made every possible mistake, I'm sure. But even testing my relationship, I mean, we'd talk on the phone. That was it. She was doing uni and living in Sydney. I was in the mountains, living in the storeroom of my store. That's where I'd sleep at nighttime. And she'd come up after uni on Friday afternoons, and we'd work the weekend shift together, and then I'd drive her home on Sunday night and then get back up at 3:30 in the morning, head back up to the mountains. And I think most couples, it would have broken them, and that was the ultimate test for us, is that it just brought us together. She was just as driven as what I was. Wow. Either just as driven or hell of a supportive person, because she was happy. She would turn up every Friday with a smile on her face and hold my hand, support me through it. So
probably more the latter.
Always has been. Always has been.
Yeah. Great team.
Yeah, great fam. Best team. Best team.
And what happened after that first store? How did your business journey evolve from there?
So first couple of years were really quite challenging, mainly around cash flow, learning. I was a kid, I really didn't know much about business at all. And we made I made lots of mistakes. I really, you know, I'm not very computer literate still to this day. I'm not that advanced on it. And so I had a lot of challenges in the first few years. And where things probably changed was I had learnt the mistakes and managed to survive my way through. I had learnt to become what I think is a good retailer. I knew what it was to run a good store. I was obsessed with customer experience, still am to this day. That's just in my blood. I like helping people. I like seeing them smile. So that helped. And then Nadia joined. So my wife joined the business. She finished uni and joined, and that really helped because I had somebody who had the tech ability to help me advance there. And we just kind of grew. So by year three, we were the number one IGA store in Australia. We had the highest sales per square meter. And it kind of gave us the cash flow. We started to see other opportunities. The opportunity at Mount Victoria came up. There was a construction a project going there to build a truck stop. And I was speaking with the developer. I got to know him and ultimately bought that site. So we bought that site, and that was the beginning of the next venture. And it kind of progressed from there. Suddenly now we had a 24-hour business with a restaurant and an NRMA road service and very different kind of retail operation. But again, you were there. We went through and we built it.
Mm.
We learned every other mistake to make in that and survived.
Ticking off more mistakes, I can attest to that. It's interesting, like the story so far, it just seems like success built upon success, built upon success. Yes, a lot of, mistakes or mini failures, but generally would you agree the story was a success story? And did it continue on in your eyes? When did you feel like it may have changed? Because is it fair to say at that point in time, it's almost like you couldn't do anything wrong, anything majorly wrong in business?
Yeah, sure. It certainly looked that way from the outside, and for the most part, it was great. I think I do have a great ability to just move on when mistakes have been made. Just correct. One thing that I probably didn't include, and it's a great takeaway for the listeners, is at about coming on to year three. It would have been around that 3 year mark. I remember I'd built the store up to be capable of having weekend staff, so I didn't have to work 7 days. And I remember going home one Sunday. Well, I still worked half day Saturday, but I was home on Sunday one night. I got up on Monday morning and I didn't want to go to work. And I had staff there, and it was the first time actually in my life where I guess chucked a sickie. I didn't go to my own business. And no one really asked anything. They were more worried about me being sick. Anyway, this went on day after day for a week. I had hit a wall. I actually realized I hated the place. I resented it. And I resented it because I'd just gone too hard. I'd lived at the thing for 3 years. I'd lost my identity. I didn't know anything other than that store. And I just couldn't face it. I didn't want to go back. So I guess I was having a little mini meltdown. The good news is that I then had to teach the staff how to do those final pieces that I was doing, things like banking, etc. Handed that over, and I just really stepped back from the business. And as a result, it went down a little bit for about 6 months. And it forced me to put in place a manager. I took a bit of a back seat, and then I went back in with full force. I'd re-energized, I guess, and the business then went to the whole new level. Again, from the outside, customers wouldn't see it. But I think everyone goes through that in their life. They have these moments where maybe not everyone else sees what goes on, but I know what happened behind the scenes. As it turns out, it was a blessing in disguise because it taught me to actually be an owner of the business and learn to put in systems to run it without me. But at the time, it was pretty dark, to be honest. To wake up and feel like, you know, going from Energizer Bunny can do 18 hours a day, no problem, to not wanting to go was a little scary at the time. But it taught me some valuable lessons and took us to a new level.
Mm. What was that like when you did hand over to that manager and you were able to kind of step back and play more of an owner's role? Was that difficult to let go for you?
Not really. I think I was so broken that I found it pretty easy.
Like, fuck that, you can have it.
Yeah, that's right. Take it. Right. And really didn't give a shit. I couldn't care if the place burnt down at that point. I was just done.
Yeah.
I just reached the point of exhaustion. But, you know, it was hard for them, actually, more so than me, because when you're there all day, every day, and then you just say, I don't want to come here anymore, it's very demotivating, like, for rejected. The team. Yeah, felt they took it quite hard. Mm. Thankfully, they're really loyal. Great, great guys. Great kids, actually. They just finished high school. I was there. That was their first job, and they stayed with me right to the time I sold that store 7 years later. Wow. So great staff, and they've gone and done really well for themselves. I'm pleased to tell everybody too. But that was a learning experience for everybody. And then over the years, going back to that question, how did life go? Things were great back then. We had our first two boys, and we bought a house and renovated it. Everything was great. And then we decided to sell all the stores and move back to Sydney and invest in some other companies. And again, got some great traction initially until I invested into a friend's company, then it didn't go so well.
And maybe what we'll just, if we just go back a moment there, just with, obviously, because we ended up building, you know, a bit of a portfolio of stores. When would you say was the first time that you had your first kind of, you know, major problem or, you know, you really kind of fell down the first time in a significant way in business?
I think there's a few there. So one was the meltdown, that feeling there.
That's the first.
Yeah, another one came about when there was an invoicing issue. I still remember it to this day, with Tip Top, and they had introduced new technology called cross-docking with IGA. I remember getting a call from the CFO of Tip Top saying, listen, there's been an error and you owe us $140,000. And I said, well, that's, I don't know, you must have the wrong number. That can't be possible. And anyway, it was right. And that was a lot of money back then. To me, that was not something we had in reserves, that's for sure. So that put a lot of pressure on the business for about 18 months whilst we repaid that. And so there was multiple moments through there. We also had an investment. Even when we were doing the development of the truck stop, there was a shortfall on cash. When we went and did another site out at Lithgow, I did the development there, and then a deal with Woolworths didn't go quite so to plan. So I almost got us into a really bad spot there. Ended up just taking works into my own hands and recouping it, at least getting it so that we didn't lose money. But that was a really big moment that could have gone bad, like bad to the $1 million tune or worse.
Yeah. Yep.
And then also with the truck stop too, went to sell it, had done amazing work to set it up, blue chip tenant, all of those things. And then just as we're about to sell, the government announces we're doing a feasibility on a bypass, which would bypass your truck stop. A truck stop with a bypass isn't worth anything. So that was a big moment there also. Huge. Yeah. So there was multiple moments throughout the journey.
Yeah. That was probably around the time of the GFC too, from memory.
Correct. GFC hit. There was a number of things. And that also timed with the investment that I'd done in Sydney. Mm. So I went from owning multiple properties to having a situation where I needed to sell at a time that was the worst possible time to sell in order to keep everything afloat. And it was a pretty low moment. That was, gut-wrenching. Effectively, I'd gone from nothing at 21 to being really well established by 26, 27, and also living a really great life with my kids and my family, and then was back to, I lost it, pretty much all of it, and working, you know, 18 hours a day trying to fix the problem of the company that I'd invested in. So it was dark, not a good time.
Just want to hear you say that. I think to myself, you know, back in my journey, there's been times where there's been some fateful moments that I knew if it would have panned out, you know, if I, the flip of the coin would have been the other side, I would have been bowled out. Mm-hmm. I think there's multiple times in my life, fortunate for me, I never got that side of the coin, even though it was there. It was a genuine 50-50. I can only thank my lucky stars. But in those moments, I did look and say, wow, I'm going to lose this all here. I'm going to go back to square one. And I felt like I was struggling with my own identity, like that I would be literally worthless in every sense of the word if I did. You going through that moment, did you struggle with your own identity and self-worth at that moment?
There was certainly feelings of, am I doomed? Like, have I always had this curse over me? I used to ask myself many times growing up, like, yeah, that why me? Why am I going home to this nightmare and other kids get to go home? I'd see kids getting picked up from school in cars. We never had a car, ever. I'd hear about stuff on TV. We didn't have a TV, ever. You know, even the basics of food. So there was, you grow up like that and you think, oh, this is not nice. Then you make it and you have these things and then bang, it's taken away. And taken away in that moment for what I felt I hadn't done anything wrong. Like it was completely outside my control. All of the ones that I just listed before, you know, my stuff ups with different things, stock control and all these things, most of them, it was just down to my L plates in business.
Yeah, a bit of ignorance.
Yeah, like I just didn't know. I didn't know what I didn't know. In this particular instance, I felt like it was a bit rough how hard it had hit me, how much it took of our family, from our family. And so that was a bitter pill for me to swallow, and it made me think, am I doomed? Like, this is what life is like, right? It didn't feel very fair. But those moments of feeling that were short-lived because I had to either agree that I'm doomed and jump off a building or get back to work because there's a family to feed and there's a business to try and fix. So I didn't have time to wallow in my sorrows. I put it this way, I never took a day off. I've never had a day off and just sat on the beach having a cry. I just got back to work. I've had moments when I was driving home at 2 o'clock in the morning thinking, I just want to end it. This is too painful. But then I'd just get back up a few hours later and go back to it and say, you better get on with the job. Like, you know, that was it. So that was yeah, definitely had moments where it was low points. And,
you know, it's not easy to talk about, but I think we all, anyone that's been in business for as long as kind of you have and I have, there's been moments where, you know, it's kind of bottom of the barrel. And what I hear you saying is, I'm just going to get back to work. You know, it's like one foot in front of the other. What did that look like? In a practical level, like, was that getting back to a new business? Was that trying to create something new from the ashes?
It's interesting when I'm talking about it because I think that there was two moments in my 42 years of being on this planet that hit the lowest point. One was when I was 13. I'd just left home and I was living on my own. And I remember specifically, I'd probably been out for maybe three or four months. And nobody knew. I'd kept it secret from my friends. And I'd go home and every night I remember sitting in this back room trying to do my homework and I'd just cry. I missed my mum terribly. Despite all her flaws, I missed her a lot. And it was very lonely when you're a kid. You don't have anyone. It was pretty lonely. And I remember thinking to myself, I just got to end it. Like this, I'm done. It'd be a lot easier if I just ended it. And I remember specifically thinking how I was going to do it. I remember just crying. And funny enough, I had this music going in the background. And like this, you know, back then I guess I'm still listening to it, like the hip-hop R&B. But you hear some of the lyrics of these people that have been through the same similar kind of problems. And they kind of talk about how they just, they fight for what they know that they deserve. And I thought to myself, if I end it, I feel like I'll succumbing to my stepfathers and everybody who had influenced me in a negative way. Or I can stop crying, just get on with it and go and prove myself, try my best, see what happens. And so I chose the latter, and I never cried again after that. It was just get down to business. I didn't have any plan. My plan was get up every day and do the best that I can. And as I shared, I failed a million times on that journey. The second time that was the lowest was one night driving home at the peak of, it would have been 2009, 2010. We'd sold all the properties. I'd run out of money. Credit cards were full. And I remember driving home. It was like 1 o'clock in the morning. I was exhausted and I just thought, I failed. I don't actually have any more options. I don't know how to fix this. I remember thinking to myself, I could just like steer into this telegraph pole and it'd be all over. And I knew one thing I maintained was my life insurance. Thought my family will have money. They're going to get paid out really well and they'll be okay and happier, right? Like I thought, because I'm not exactly a great like person. I'm never there anyway. They wouldn't even notice the difference. They don't see me. And that's pretty dark when you've got a couple of little boys at home in particular. It's sad. I remember driving in the driveway and thinking, you got to cut that shit out, man. This is not healthy. And so that was also that moment. I had my cry in the car and then I just said, no more, get on with it. And I think what it did was I went in there the next day. I was ruthless around, you know, cutting costs and just getting to the bottom of it. And I got into, I guess, massive action, making changes. And I did that. And one day at a time, I kind of worked it out and sorted that business out. And I did go into another business. By chance, the person who I'd asked to help, a lady who was helping me with some business consulting, I really loved what she was doing. That's where I started to get the hand, and that's actually what ultimately led me to end up in this field.
What did you love about it?
I love the simplicity of the tools that they actually worked, and the fact that I felt that most people in business didn't know them. And I thought, why is there this gap? There's entrepreneurs out there trying to make it and they're not taught these fundamentals. And so having learnt them and applied them to another business I had an interest in, saw the results there, shared it with some other friends, saw them get the results. It was just like a no-brainer to me. I thought, this is an answer that people need to know. And I felt at that moment that I guess I'd found my life's passion. It was connecting that thing of helping people, which I've always loved doing, with the whole entrepreneurialism, that piece. Because I love business. I do get a kick out of business. The kick that I get out of business is watching them grow and service people. That's my kick. I like to see them, you know, creating great jobs for people where people genuinely love where they work. And great service products to their community. I think that's cool. So if I was able to be a part of that, I reckon that's pretty cool. And that's ultimately what happened. I bought into her business, grew it, found EOS, brought it to Australia and grew it.
And effectively kind of, so the last decade or longer,
yeah,
you've effectively been in that business consulting, coaching space.
Correct.
Pretty much getting on the outside and helping business owners improve their businesses, get what they want from their business.
Yeah, 12 or 13 years now doing the same thing. And it certainly came with its challenges. The introversion part is not congruent with public speaking.
But by that stage, did you feel like you'd grown out of that introversion to some extent?
No, I still don't think I have. I still am not one that enjoys going to networking or any of those things. I'm happy to speak at an event, but then I just want to go home. I don't really want to meet a whole lot of people. It's not my happy space. I feel kind of awkward. But so the answer to that is no, I definitely hadn't. It's, yeah. But I had to master the public speaking. I use that loosely. Certainly not a master of public speaking. But I know how to do it. I don't get up there and completely stutter the whole time. I can't get up there and be comfortable at least. And particularly when you're talking about something that you're passionate about. I love what we do. And so I like talking about it and sharing it with others. So, yeah, the public speaking thing was probably the biggest challenge to overcome in those early years of getting into this space. Yeah.
I think you're being a bit modest there. You're very, very good at that. But interestingly, over the, you know, getting into that business consulting space, was that strange getting on the other side and then, you know, almost seeing business from the other side? And what was the challenges being able to be outside someone's business yet being their coach, their advisor, their consultant? What were the hard things initially with that for you?
A couple of hard things, and they still apply to this day. One of them is, well, I mean, I've gotten pretty good at this thing, but one of them is to be effective, you need to be really comfortable with having uncomfortable conversations. And telling an entrepreneur, a visionary in particular, that they're probably doing something wrong or they need to do something differently is not an easy thing to do, particularly when you're a type of person that likes to be liked. I am that. That's what actually made me good at retail is I love serving people. I love seeing them happy. So my whole world up until that point was about making people smile. Now I was in a situation where sometimes I had to make people not smile, right?
Upset them a bit.
Yeah, I had to piss them off sometimes. Yeah. And that was confronting for me. It wasn't my happy space. And also having confrontation was not a happy thing for me, given my childhood. I didn't like it.
Mm.
And so I certainly had to do a lot of work on myself to be able to have those conversations. And actually the co-founder of EOS, Don Tinney, is somebody who helped me really dial that in. He had the ability, very wise guy, he had the ability to really nail in on this police thing. He said, so you really, I can tell you really still want to do this. You love it. And I said, I think ultimately I like to do something that's purposeful and helps people. And he said, so if you really want to help people, do you think telling them, sharing with them what they need to hear is helping or not helping? And he said, because I feel you've got a bit of resistance to it. And I said, well, it feels bad, but I know it's right. And he said, basically talked me through it to the point where I guess he brainwashed me to realize that if I can have a tough conversation, they'll smile someday down the track and I will be helping. I'll be doing the right thing. Mm. The right thing is to say what they need to hear.
Mm. And that's great. And, you know, I can relate to that. I think any human being, I mean, I'd say the majority of human beings, you know, don't like confrontation and avoid it yet in their coaching role.
Mm.
You've got to be that instigator at the time to get people to look. How much before you operated that business and started kind of serving other entrepreneurs and helping them, how much do you attribute the experience that you had in the decade or two prior being in business to you being kind of a great coach, great facilitator for leadership teams?
I think probably a lot, mainly in the area of empathy. I can understand what they're going through. I get what it feels like to have everything on the line. It's tough. It's scary. And it's frustrating and it feels thankless and sometimes unfair. So I think in that sense, yeah, it definitely helped. It helped that also I hadn't just been in one industry. I actually had been in multiple businesses in different industries. So I'd seen how different things work, and that definitely has served me well when I'm working with clients.
Mm.
Yeah.
And then obviously, you know, through your minis, I would imagine you've helped hundreds of business owners and their leadership teams. You've impacted, you know, hundreds, you know, would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I've personally worked direct with about 80, 85, and then 450 through the business consulting that I had before that. So,
What would you say is the common denominator with the business owners and the leadership teams that really outperform Because let's face it, not everyone outperforms or even performs, and the statistics show that, you know, half don't even exist after 3 or so years, 5 or so years. I'm interested in to know the correlation. What's in common with those high performers throughout all your experience working with them?
That's a good question. I think the thing that comes to mind when I think about the best teams, the ones that perform really well above even the normal ones that I'm working with, are they have a great culture. They genuinely value their people, and yet they also have, they're obsessed with making sure that they've got the right people in the right seats in their organization. They really value having great talent. In contrast, if you look at some who have struggled, there are people who are fearful of having somebody in the room that's smarter than them. They're the ones who struggle. And it's ironically the ones who say, I just wish people could do their jobs. It's like, you're the one who's hiring people who are substandard.
And managing them.
Yeah, and they're not managing them correctly. So I think people who care for their people well, look after their people, create a great environment for them to work in. And I'm not talking about beanbags and fairy lights. I'm talking about just a great culture where there's clear expectations, clear values in the business, and people actually do what they say. That works really well. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, and I can relate to this being kind of in a similar space to you. You know, we're kind of, one of the great things about what we do is that we're exposed to this technology and tools. We live it and breathe it every day. We're helping other entrepreneurs and their leadership teams implement it in their business. We get to learn a lot, is what I'm saying.
Mm.
What would be the few things that, if you could have your time again, going back to that first business, and maybe even that second business, that you would change, you would do differently now that you know what you know now?
That's a really good one. My initial response was everything. No, but
yeah, you can't steal my answer.
Yeah, that's right. No, the truth is, I don't know. Like, we have to look at the end result, right? After 3 years, it was the number one store for a reason. We got it right. Right. I think we had the core things right. The core things were, we loved our customers. We obsessed over them. And still to this day, I do the same thing. And I loved my people. My team were looked after well. It felt like a family. And that still applies today. So the very basics that have served me all the way through have done really well. So I wouldn't change any of that. What would I change? I probably would have acted faster on things. I knew that I wasn't good with technology. Probably would have brought somebody in quicker to help with that kind of thing. And I would have realized that I am a visionary type person. I'm not the person that should be there running the day-to-day business every day. I would have been looking for somebody earlier, an integrator, a GM, somebody who can run the day-to-day operation effectively, be more stable than what I was. Those are the things that would probably change. And I would have loved if somebody handed me a traction book when I was 21. That would have been really helpful.
Yep.
But, you know, it's funny. I always say, in hindsight, would I have read it, A, because I was probably so busy. And when you haven't experienced certain things, you don't appreciate the answers until you've experienced the problem.
Would you have really related or appreciated
it?
Interesting. And yeah, throughout that experience, you know, now where you sit, what does life look like now for you? So you're still in the same industry?
Yeah, so now
you mentioned EOS.
Yep.
Talk to us a little bit about that for the audience who doesn't know what EOS is.
So EOS, the Entrepreneurial Operating System, founded by Gino Wickman out of Detroit, Michigan, in the early 2000s. And he developed this system. I actually, funny how the world works. So I had my consulting business, as I shared. I'd actually bought out my business partner, the original lady who'd started it, and I was running it. I got the opportunity to go and visit Richard Branson's island, Necker Island. So great opportunity. Went there to spend a week there. As it turned out, some things happened and they asked me to speak, be one of the speakers there for one of the breakout sessions. And I did that. And as it turns out, a lady comes up after the event, after I spoke, and a lady by the name of Dion Spatieri. And she says, "Oh, have you heard about this thing called EOS? You've got this twin brother called Gino in Detroit." And she said, "I'm an EOS implementer. Have you heard about it?" I said, "Nah, I haven't heard about it." She said, "Get a book called Traction. You'll love it." And so I did. And I read it on the plane and I thought, wow, she was spot on. Fell in love with it. So flew back to the US not so long after, did my training. Learned all about EOS, and they gave me the opportunity to bring the brand here. So I bought the brand here and started it from scratch by myself, built it up from there to the community what it is today.
You are the man who built the community in Australia.
Yeah, well, myself and Francesca, yeah, my sidekick there, and And some other great people, early adopters, came on as EOS implementers: Anthony Wood, Roger Vitanis, Martin Quinn, a couple of the crazies who were willing to jump on early.
Yeah.
And I built from there, and it's been great. It's been one real blessing. It's been great. And we've got a great community here now. You're part of it. So, yeah, it's absolutely. That's it. So, yeah, you know what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And still enjoying the work that you do. Like, obviously you've got, you know, a big client list, delivering the tools, still loving it?
Yeah, I do. I love it. One of the things that changed for me a couple of years ago was being very selective about who I work with now.
Mm.
Mostly it boils down to a values fit. Mm. When I have buy-in, when I have shared values with a team, and I buy into their purpose, why they exist, it makes me feel like part of the team. I come in as excited as they are about what we're doing. Some would argue that I'm more excited about it, but
than they are.
Yeah, but I love it. I love having the ability to be with the leadership team every day and helping them build something special that we're proud of. And I'm really blessed with the people that I get to work with every day. Some super talented and just great human beings. And that's why I love the job that I do. Mm. Holding their hand and working through their challenges and building something that's sustainable and something that will last forever. That's my hope.
Yeah, absolutely. I can relate to that. And, you know, when you're talking about clients and, you know, being able to have the privilege to work with clients that share the values and clients that you want to work for. Obviously, when you're starting a business, particularly a consulting practice, you've got to get out there and be known and start working with people. How do you reconcile, and you probably experienced this when you started, having to build a client list and maybe not quite gelling with some clients, yet having the opposing force of needing to build your business? How did you reconcile that in the early years?
In the early days, I was the only person representing the brand in the whole of the Asia-Pac region. So, open honest, I had no choice. If they inquired about EOS and wanted to do it, I had to service them. So there was a couple, thankfully, less than a handful, that I used to have to grit my teeth and do my job and move on. So I did it. There's only ever been one that I've actually fired. It's just I thought they were negligent, and they were. They ended spectacularly 6 months later, as I predicted. But the rest of them, I just worked my way through. It was harder work than what it is when you wake up and you've got a values alignment. And I think that applies to, it's a really important lesson for everybody. It applies not only in the work we do, but it very much applies to all businesses. Mm. I think people often overlook the importance of working with customers that are aligned, that, and what I mean by that is they value you and you value them. It's a two-way street. And some people just think that they've got to accept every client that walks in the door. And I guess in some businesses like retail, you have very little control over that. But in this business, I believe being choosy about who you work with makes a big difference to your satisfaction and enjoyment with your business. And so I'd rather go with no client than one that I don't like working with, because it's really draining. Versus it's the opposite. It's energizing when you're with a company and a group that you love, even despite whatever challenges they're going through.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I can relate to that.
And one final point on that is like attracts like, right? So they will refer you their friends. Their friends are like them.
Yeah.
So when you take on, I'll keep it tidy here, when you take on non-fit clients, the ones that aren't aligned with your value set, they're likely going to refer you their friends. So you're going to get more of it. That's a problem. So stick with the ones that are great.
Point taken. You know, sometimes there's this thing called luck in business. Do you believe you need luck in business?
Yeah. A lot of people say create your own luck. I believe in that for sure. Okay. Just as I explained earlier with the early years of my business, like just working the way that I did, having the discipline that I did, created what would be considered the luck with the way that the suppliers helped me with my first store. Was it luck or was it actually my reputation? It was probably my reputation, but there's an element of luck there too. Even coming across that store, that was a little bit lucky. Right, but I was working when I didn't have to. I could have been playing video games or sitting at the park doing anything. I was choosing to drive the boss around. Was that luck? I don't know. There's definitely an element of luck in it. Sometimes things just don't go your way. What I will say to it, though, is at least from my experience, from every misfortune has come a blessing. There is something there. You just got to be able to see it. And it's very difficult to see it when you're right in the middle of it. When it's very dark, it's very hard to see it. It's like me being in this space, doing this work that I do today. There's not a chance I would be here if I had not had the 2008 to 2011, that blow up. I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have come into this space. I highly doubt it.
Do you feel like on net balance you've had luck in business or you've been unlucky to this point?
That's really good. I don't know whether I'd say it's 50-50. There's certainly been, put it this way, there's been some great luck and some big hits, some bad luck, one could say. But like I say, I feel pretty lucky to be where I am now. It's a great spot. I enjoy my life. Financially, had those other things not happened, probably be in a much better spot, but that's okay. Who knows what else could have happened though, right? That's the thing. It's always the what ifs. I don't know what would have happened. Maybe I would have invested in something else and blown it anyway, so who knows?
Maybe you would have become a cop.
Maybe I would be. Maybe I still will.
Maybe you will. So what do you say to the youth of today who are studying, they're going through high school and they're in the system, and that system, let's face it, teaches people how to be great employees. Universities and business degrees, again, teaches people how to be great technicians or managers. What do you say to that person that's got that entrepreneurial vein and wants to get into business at 21, like you and I did? What comes to mind is your advice to them?
First and foremost, get a job, right? I say it to my kids. Work experience is the best thing that anyone can do. Don't get hung up on what job it is. Like I say, working in a service station on weekends, my mates would call me and laugh. They're out nightclubbing and having fun, and I was working at the store in Quakers Hill, and you don't realize how much you learn from these experiences. Get out and try different things. And if you hate something, don't hang around and in misery, just leave. Go to another industry and learn to be passionate about what you do. I'm proud about the way that I ran those stores when I was working on that console. I cleaned those toilets better than anybody. I still believe it to this day. I mopped the floors better than anyone. I was proud about the process of how I could run that store, and it still serves me to this day, the things that I learned doing that. Rather than seeing a negative, I saw the positive of just wanting to be the best at whatever I was doing at the time, and it made it more enjoyable than moping around. So get work experience. Discover the value of learning. I think at school, many of us don't enjoy it. Certainly a lot of entrepreneurs struggle in it. And my upset there is we unfortunately, the takeaway is we think we don't like to learn. We don't like education. Education doesn't have to be at school or uni. You can read books. You can go and try different things. Go to an Anthony Robbins seminar, right? It wasn't necessarily for me, but I enjoyed the couple of hours I hung out there, right? Landmark Forum, went and did that. That's different, right? So just be open to trying out new things and seeing where it takes you. And above all else, in those early years, just remember your reputation is everything. If you're a sleep-in person, be late person, you're not reliable, you don't do what you say, it'll stick, right? So just don't be that person. Be the opposite. You know, put in the effort regardless of what the job is. Just if it's a service station job, treat it like it's your dream job. People remember it. They'll watch the way that you turn up, the way that you dress, all those things. And just, you know, treat every opportunity as an important one. And I think that's the things that I would suggest there. And I might as well do a book plug. Gino wrote a book called The Entrepreneurial Leap. He wrote that book a year or two ago. Well worth checking out, because it just gives you an insight as to what does it look like to be a business owner, and that it's not for everybody. One of the terms that I've heard in the last few years is called intrapreneur, where you can be that person who's got the ideas and whatnot, but you can work within a business that you don't own. Mm. You don't have to go through the stress and heartache of starting something and risking everything. You can bring those ideas to a larger business, or an established business, even a privately held family business. You can still have all that, but not have to have all the risk. And so just know that there's a few ways to live out a great life. You don't have to necessarily be the business owner or founder or any of those things. Like, there's other options out there around how you might be able to tick that box of what does my ultimate career look like.
That's great advice, mate. And I think it's probably a good segue into our kind of final four questions. Mm. I've really enjoyed the chat so far. Going to hit you with the first one. What does success in business mean to you?
I think for success for me, success in business would be being proud of what you've created. And providing you what you wanted out of your business. And that really wildly varies from person to person from what I've seen out there. But for me, it would be to be able to look and say, I'm proud of that. I helped create that. And I got whatever reward it was that you wanted for it. That would be success.
And if I told you would have earned more money and had more time to spend with your family, if you're an employee in someone else's business the last two decades rather than be a business owner, would you have got into business?
I don't know that I would have been able to stay employed. I was not the most stable employee. I worked my backside off, but I also loved running my own show, hence why I got the opportunity to run a business by myself. But no, I think I very soon, pretty early on, discovered that I had that flair. I like to kind of lead the way. I really enjoy it. But so the answer probably would be no. Unless it was a cops. Would they pay that much money? I don't know. Maybe.
Well, it's gonna be my next question. Yeah. Who was your idol growing up?
Who was my idol growing up? I don't know. It was probably some, like the police. Do you remember TJ Hooker?
I remember the name, but...
Yeah, he's down.
He'd be younger than you, mate.
I used to like...
Magnum? Did you like Magnum?
Magnum.
That's more a detective.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I liked the police show. Probably some cop.
Was the business owner that you, in the surveys, was he an idol in a way?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, when I was working for him back then, definitely there was definitely things that I idolized about the guy, but not one that I fully because he definitely had flaws that I was very aware of and yeah. that I was not aligned to some of the things. Yeah, so not everything. In the business sense, yes, I really loved. I thought he was very talented at what he did. He was a great retailer, and I still, right to the end, aspired to be as good as him. He was a very good retailer, no doubt.
How do you think your industry will be different 10 years from now?
I just think that there'll be more awareness of how it can help. And my hope is that it's got a better reputation than what it has today. I don't think it's got a particularly bad one. I just think that a lot of people perhaps have tried a coach or consultant in the past and not gotten what they wanted and therefore not felt that it was a great experience. And so every day that I'm working with my clients, I really remind myself of we're representing a bigger cause here, and it's an important one, not only about them getting what they need, but about them spreading the word to other entrepreneurs that there is help there. It's an important message. What we do every day, I really wholeheartedly believe in, to the same degree like I believed in the cops. Like I really believe in it. And I feel very grateful to be part of a journey, like part of a group that's pushing that message out there that we're here to help. Because too many entrepreneurs and their businesses and teams are suffering when they don't need to. They don't need to. There is a better way to do things. And so that's what I think will be different. I think they'll realise, hey, there's good help out there. That's what I think will change.
That's great. And for our listeners out there, if they'd like to connect with you, what's the best way they connect with you, either online or offline?
Just LinkedIn is probably the best thing. Daniel Davis.
You get on there, do you?
Not really. Francesca runs it. Church. I do check it. I like to see. I do go on to LinkedIn actually because it's kind of the social media that allows me to see all my clients. I love watching what they're up to.
Yeah.
I like seeing their posts. So yeah, I actually I am a LinkedIn person. I do like it. Okay. So yeah, you can reach out there, send a message.
Or
EOS Worldwide website too. There's a directory on there that has my details there. You can connect through there.
Okay.
As with any of the implementers from the community, 450, I think, out there.
Yeah.
And 25 in our local region.
Yeah.
Check them out.
And growing.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Daniel, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show today. Obviously, spoiler alert, you know, I'm very close to you and I've had the privilege of, you know, being up front and close for most of the journey, but still to spend the last hour with you and go over the memories, good, bad and indifferent, I've really enjoyed it. And I appreciate your openness, your honesty and just the heart. One thing I will say about you, Daniel, and I want to acknowledge you for is just, you know, look up the word resilience in the dictionary. You're going to find a picture of Daniel Davis. You always land on your feet and it takes an incredible amount of effort and skill and, tenacity and resilience to be able to do that. So I just want to acknowledge you for that.
Yeah, thank you.
And I really appreciate you sharing the story with the listeners.
Yeah, my pleasure and great to be on. I'm excited about this podcast. It's really great and I think couldn't be a better host. You were born to do this stuff. Over the years, you've been a great a great listening ear and always had great questions to ask me throughout the challenges that I've faced over the last, whatever it's been, 25 years of my life with you. So, yeah, great to be on.
Loved it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, brother.
Cheers.